knowledge that when I'd taken off my clothes, he'd been nearby watching me.
"I like your pants," he said with a little smirk.
He took off his backpack and set it down.
"Or leggings, if that's what they're called."
"I don't know what you're talking about," I said numbly, though I could hardly hear my own words for what felt like a great clanging in my head, which was the realization that my whole hike on the PCT could come to this, that no matter how tough or strong or brave I'd been, how comfortable I'd come to be with being alone, I'd also been lucky, and that if my luck ran out now, it would be as if nothing before it had ever existed, that this one evening would annihilate all those brave days.
"I'm talking about liking your pants," the man said with a touch of irritation. "They look good on you. They show off your hips and legs."
"Please don't say that," I said as unfalteringly as I could.
"What? I'm complimenting you. Can't a guy give a girl a compliment anymore? You should be flattered."
"Thank you," I said in an attempt to pacify him, hating myself for it. My mind went to the three young bucks who perhaps weren't even back on the trail yet. It went to the world's loudest whistle that no one but the red-haired man would hear. It went to the Swiss Army knife too far away in the upper left side pocket of my pack. It went to the not yet boiling water in the handleless pot on my little stove. And then it landed on the arrows that rose from the top of the sandy-haired man's pack. I could feel the invisible line between those arrows and me like a hot thread. If he tried to do anything to me, I'd get to one of those arrows and stab him in the throat.
"I think you'd better get going," I said evenly. "It'll be getting dark soon."
I crossed my arms hard against my chest, acutely aware of the fact that I wasn't wearing a bra.
"It's a free country," he said. "I'll go when I'm ready. I got a right, you know."
He picked up his Pepsi can and gently swirled around the water inside.
"What the hell are you doing?"
a man's voice called, and a moment later the red-haired man appeared.
"I had to hike all the way back up here to find you. I thought you got lost."
He looked at me accusingly, as if I were to blame, as if I'd conspired with the sandy-haired man to get him to stay.
"We got to go now if we're going to make it back to the truck before dark."
"You be careful out here," the sandy-haired man said to me, pulling on his pack.
"Bye," I said very quietly, wanting neither to answer him nor to rile him by not answering.
"Hey, it's 7:10, he said. "It's safe to drink the water now."
He lifted his Pepsi can in my direction and made a toast.
"Here's to a young girl all alone in the woods," he said, and took a sip, and then turned to follow his friend down the trail.
I stood for a while, the way I had the first time they left, letting all the knots of fear unclench. Nothing had happened, I told myself. I am perfectly okay. He was just a creepy, horny, not nice man, and now he's gone. But then I shoved my tent back into my pack, turned off my stove, dumped the almost boiling water out into the grass, and swished the pot in the pond so it cooled. I took a swig of my iodine water and crammed my water bottle and my damp t-shirt, bra, and shorts back into my pack. I lifted Monster, buckled it on, stepped onto the trail, and started walking northward in the fading light. I walked and I walked, my mind shifting into a primal gear that was void of anything but forward motion. And I walked until walking became unbearable, until I believed I couldn't walk even one more step. And then I ran. Chapter 18, Queen of the PCT. It was raining when I woke as the light seeped into the sky the next morning. I was lying in my tent in the shallow trough of the trail, its 2-foot width the only flat spot I could find in the dark the night before. It had begun to rain at midnight, it had rained all night long, and as I walked through the morning, the rain came and went. I thought about what had happened with the men, or almost happened, or was never really going to happen, playing it over in my mind, feeling sick and shaky, but by noon it was behind me and I was back on the PCT,
the detour I'd inadvertently taken having wended its way up to the trail. Water fell from the sky and dripped from the branches, streaming down the gully of the trail. I walked beneath the enormous trees, the forest canopy high above me, the bushes and low-growing plants that edged the trail soaking me as I brushed past. Wet and miserable as it was, the forest was magical, gothic in its green grandiosity, both luminous and dark, so lavish in its fecundity that it looked surreal, as if I were walking through a fairy tale rather than the actual world. It rained and rained and rained off and on through that day and all through the next. It was still raining in the early evening when I reached the shores of the 240-acre Olali Lake. I walked past the closed ranger station feeling a deep sense of relief, clomping over the mud and wet grass through a small cluster of picnic tables to the little collection of dark wooden buildings that constituted the Olali Lake Resort. Until I'd hiked through Oregon, I'd had a profoundly different idea of what the word resort might suggest. No one was in sight. The 10 primitive cabins scattered near the lake shore all looked empty, and the tiny store amid the cabins was closed for the night. It began to rain again as I stood under a lodgepole pine near the store. I pulled the hood of my raincoat up over my head and looked at the lake. The grand peak of Mount Jefferson supposedly loomed to the south, and the squat rise of Olali Butte sat to the north, but I couldn't see either of them, obscured as they were by the growing dark and the fog. Without the mountain views, the pines and wide lake reminded me of the north woods of Minnesota. The air felt like Minnesota, too. It was a week past Labor Day. Autumn hadn't arrived yet, but it was close. Everything felt abandoned and forlorn. I dug inside my raincoat, pulled out the pages of my guidebook, and read about a place to camp nearby, a site beyond the ranger station that overlooked Head Lake, Olali's much smaller neighbor. I made camp there and cooked my dinner in the rain, then crawled into my tent and lay in my damp sleeping bag, dressed in my damp clothes. The batteries of my headlamp had gone dead, so I couldn't read. Instead, I lay listening to the spatter of raindrops against the taut nylon a few feet from my head. There would be fresh batteries in my box tomorrow. There would be Hershey's chocolate kisses that I'd dole out to myself over the next week. There would be the last batch of dehydrated meals and bags of nuts and seeds that had gone stale. The thought of these things was both a torture and a comfort to me. I curled into myself, trying to keep my sleeping bag away from the edges of my tent in case it leaked, but I couldn't fall asleep. Dismal as it was, I felt a spark of light travel through me that had everything to do with the fact that I'd be done hiking the trail in about a week. I'd be in Portland, living like a normal person again. I'd get a job waiting tables in the evenings, and I'd write during the day. Ever since the idea of living in Portland had settled in my mind, I'd spent hours imagining how it would feel to be back in the world, where food and music, wine and coffee could be had. Of course, heroin could be had there too, I thought, but the thing was, I didn't want it. Maybe I never really had. I'd finally come to understand what it had been, a yearning for a way out, when actually what I had wanted to find was a way in. I was there now, or close. "I've got a box," I called to the ranger the next morning, chasing him as he began to drive away in his truck. He stopped and rolled down his window. "You Cheryl?" I nodded. "I have a box," I repeated, still buried inside my putrid rain gear. "Your friends told me about you," he said as he got out of his truck. "The married couple." I blinked and pushed my hood off. "Sam and Helen?" I asked, and the ranger nodded. The thought of them sent a surge of tenderness through me. I pulled the hood back up over my head as I followed the ranger into the garage that was connected to the ranger station, which was connected to what appeared to be his living quarters. "I'm going to town, but I'll be back later this afternoon if you need anything," he said, and handed me my box and three letters. He was brown-haired and mustached, late 30s, I guessed. "Thanks," I said, hugging the box and letters. It was still raining and wretched outside, so I walked to the little store, where I bought a cup of coffee from the old man who worked the cash register, on the promise I'd pay for it once I opened my box. I sat drinking it in a chair by the wood stove and read my letters. The first was from Amy, the second from Paul. The third, much to my surprise, from Ed, the trail angel I'd met way back in Kennedy Meadows. "If you get this, it means you've made it, Cheryl. Congrats," he wrote. I was so touched to read his words that I laughed out loud, and the old man by the cash register looked up.
"Good news from home?" he asked.
"Yeah," I said, "something like that." I opened my box and found not only the envelope that held my $20, but another envelope that held another $20, the one that was meant to have been in my box at the Shelter Cove Resort, which I must have mispacked months before. It was all the same now. I'd made it through with my 2 pennies, and my reward was that I was now rich with $40.02. I paid for my coffee, bought a packaged cookie, and asked the man if there were any showers, but he only shook his head as I looked at him crestfallen. It was a resort without showers or a restaurant. There was a driving, drizzling rain, and it was something like 55 degrees out. I refilled my coffee cup and thought about whether I should hike on that day or not. There wasn't much reason to stay, and yet going back out to walk in the woods with all my wet things was not only dispiriting, but possibly dangerous. The inescapable wet chill put me at risk of hypothermia. At least I could sit in the warmth of the store. I'd been alternately sweating hot or freezing cold for going on 3 days. I was tired, both physically and psychologically. I'd hiked a few half days, but I hadn't had a full day off since Crater Lake. Plus, much as I looked forward to reaching the Bridge of the Gods, I wasn't in any hurry. I was close enough now that I knew I'd easily make it by my birthday. I could take my time.
"We don't have showers, young lady," said the old man, "but I can give you dinner tonight if you'd like to join me and a couple of the staff at 5.
Dinner? My decision to stay was made. I returned to my camp and did my best to dry my things out in between rain showers. I heated a pot of water and hunched naked near it, bathing myself with my bandana. I took apart my water purifier, shook out the muck that the sandy-haired man had sucked up into it, and ran clean water through my pump so I could use it again. A few minutes before I was going to walk to the small building where I'd been instructed to go for dinner, the 3 young bucks appeared, soaking wet and dreamier than ever. I literally leapt with joy at the sight of them. I explained to them that I was off to have dinner, and they could probably have dinner with me too, and I'd be right back to get them if they could. But when I reached the little building and inquired, the woman in charge was unmoved by their arrival. "We don't have enough food," she said. I felt guilty about sitting down to eat, but I was starving. Dinner was family fare, the kind I'd eaten at 1,000 potlucks as a kid in Minnesota. Cheddar cheese-topped casserole with ground beef, canned corn, and potatoes with an iceberg lettuce salad. I filled my plate and ate it in about 5 bites and sat politely waiting for the woman to cut the yellow cake with white frosting that sat enticingly on a side table. When she did, I ate a piece and then returned to discreetly take another, the biggest piece in the pan, and folded it into a paper napkin and put it in the pocket of my raincoat. "Thank you," I said. "I'd better get back to my friends." I walked across the wet grass, holding the cake very carefully inside my coat. It was only 5:30, but it was so dark and dreary it might as well have been the middle of the night.
"There you are. I was looking for you," a man called to me.
It was the ranger who'd given me my box and letters that morning. He was blotting his lips with a dish towel.
"I'm talking funny," he slurred as I approached him. "I had some surgery on my mouth today."
I pulled my hood up over my head because it had started to rain again. He seemed slightly drunk in addition to having the troubles with his mouth.
"So how about you come to my place for a drink now? You can get out of the rain," he said in his garbled voice. "My place is right there, the other half of the station. I got a fire going in the fireplace, and I'll mix you up a nice cocktail or two."
"Thanks, but I can't. My friends just got here and we're all camped," I said, gesturing to the rise beyond the road, beyond which my tent and probably by now the tents of the three young bucks were erected. As I did so, I had a precise image of what the three young bucks were likely doing at that very moment, the way they'd be crouched beneath their raincoats in the rain, trying to eat their loathsome dinners, or sitting alone in their tents because there was simply no other place to be. And then I thought of that warm fire and the booze, and how if the men went with me to drink with the ranger, I could use them to help me dodge whatever else he had in mind. "But maybe," I wavered, as the ranger drooled and then blotted his mouth. "I mean, as long as it's okay to bring my friends." I returned with the cake to our camp. The three young bucks were all zipped into their tents. "I have cake," I called, and they came and stood around me and ate it with their fingers out of my hands, splitting it among themselves in the easy, unspoken way they'd honed over months of endless deprivation and unity. In the 9 days since I'd said goodbye to them, it seemed as if we'd grown closer, more familiar, as if we'd been together in that time instead of apart. They were still the three young bucks to me, but they'd also begun to differentiate in my mind. Richie was hilarious and a little bit strange, with a dark edge of mystery I found compelling. Josh was sweet and smart, more reserved than the others. Rick was funny and incisive, kind and a great conversationalist. As I stood there with the three of them eating cake out of my hands, I realized that though I had a little crush on all of them, I had a bigger crush on Rick. It was an absurd crush, I knew. He was nearly 4 years younger than me, and we were at an age when those nearly 4 years mattered, when the gap between what he had done and what I had done was large enough that I was more like a big sister than I was someone who should be thinking about being alone with him in his tent. So I didn't think about it. But I couldn't deny that to an increasing degree, I got a little fluttery feeling inside me every time Rick's eyes met mine. And I also couldn't deny that I could see in his eyes that he got a little fluttery feeling too. "I'm sorry about dinner," I said, after explaining what had happened. "Did you guys eat?" I asked, feeling guilty, and they all nodded, licking the frosting from their fingers. "Was it good?" asked Richie in his New Orleans accent, which only increased his appeal in spite of my crush on Rick. "It was just a casserole and salad." They all three looked at me like I'd injured them. "But that's why I brought you the cake," I cried from beneath my rain hood. "Plus I have something else that might be of interest, a different sort of treat. The ranger here invited me to his place for a drink, and I told him I'd come only if you guys came too. I should warn you that he's a little bit odd. He had mouth surgery today or something, so I think he's on painkillers and a bit drunk already. But he has a fireplace with a fire in it, and he has drinks, and it's inside. Do you guys want to go?" The three young bucks gave me their barbarians loose upon the land look, and about 2 minutes later we were knocking on the ranger's door.
"There you are," he slurred as he let us in. "I was beginning to think you were going to stand me up."
"These are my friends, Rick, Richie, and Josh," I said, though the ranger only looked at them with open disdain, his dish towel still pressed to his lips. It wasn't true he'd been entirely agreeable about my bringing them along. He'd only barely consented when I'd said it was all of us or none. The three young bucks filed in and sat in a row on the couch in front of the blazing fire, propping their wet boots up on the stone hearth.
"You want a drink, good looking?" the ranger asked me as I followed him into the kitchen. "My name's Guy, by the way. I don't know if I told you that before or not."
"Nice to meet you, Guy," I said, trying to stand in a way that suggested I wasn't really with him in the kitchen so much as I was bridging the space between us and the men by the fire, and that we were all one big happy party.
"I'm making something special for you."
"For me? Thanks," I said. "Do you guys want a drink?" I called to the three young bucks. They answered in the affirmative as I watched Guy fill one gigantic plastic tumbler with ice and then pour various kinds of liquor into it and top it off with fruit punch from a can he took from the fridge. "It's like a suicide," I said when he handed it to me. "That's what we used to call this kind of drink when I was in college, where you put all different kinds of liquor in it."
Try it and see if you think it's good, said Guy.
I took a sip. It tasted like hell, but in a nice way. It tasted better than sitting out in the cold rain. Yum, I said, too cheerfully. And these guys, Rick and Richie and Josh, they'd like one too, I think. Would you guys like one? I asked again as I bolted to the couch.
Sure, they all said in a chorus, though Guy didn't acknowledge it.
I handed Rick the tumbler of booze and wedged myself in beside him, all four of us in a row in the plush wonderland of the fireside couch, without an inch to spare, the side of Rick's lovely body plastered against mine, the fire like our own personal sun before us baking us dry.
You want to talk about suicide, darling, I'll tell you about suicide, Guy said, coming to stand before me and lean against the stone mantel.
Rick drank from the tumbler and handed it to Josh on the other side of him, then Josh took a sip and handed it to Richie on the far end.
We got some dealings with suicide around here, unfortunately. Now that's where this job gets interesting, Guy said,
his eyes growing animated, his face hidden behind the dish towel from his mustache down. The tumbler made its way slowly back to me. I took a sip and handed it back to Rick, and so on, like we were smoking a gigantic liquid joint. As we drank, Guy told us, in great detail, about the scene he'd come across one afternoon when a man had blown his brains out in a porta-potty in the woods nearby.
I mean, just absolutely brains fucking everywhere, he said through the towel. More than you can imagine. Think of the most disgusting thing that you can even picture, Cheryl, and then picture that.
He stood staring only at me as if the three young bucks weren't even in the room.
Not just brains, but blood, too, and pieces of his skull and flesh just all over, splattered all over the walls inside this thing.
I can't even picture it, I said, as I shook the ice in my tumbler. The bucks had left me with sole custody of it now that it was empty.
You want another one, hot stuff? Guy asked.
I handed it to him, and he took it into the kitchen. I turned to the men, and we all looked at one another with meaningful expressions, and then burst out laughing as quietly as we could while basking in the glow of the fire.
Now, there's this other time I gotta tell you about, said Guy, returning with my drink. Only this time, it was murder. Homicide. And it wasn't brains, but blood. Gallons of blood. I mean, buckets of blood, Cheryl.
And so it went all through the evening. Afterwards, we walked back to our camp and stood around in a circle near our tents, talking half-drunk in the dark, until it started to rain again, and we had no choice but to disperse and say goodnight. When I got into my tent, I saw a puddle had formed at the far end. By morning, it was a small lake. My sleeping bag was soaked. I shook it out and looked around the campsite for a place to drape it, but it was useless. It would only get wetter as the rain continued to pour down. I carried it with me when the three young bucks and I walked to the store, holding it near the wood stove as we drank our coffee.
So we came up with a trail name for you, said Josh.
What is it? I asked reluctantly from behind the scrim of my drenched blue sleeping bag, as if it could protect me from whatever they might say.
The Queen of the PCT, said Richie. Because people always want to give you things and do things for you, added Rick. They never give us anything. They don't do a damn thing for us, in fact.
I lowered my sleeping bag and looked at them, and we all laughed. All the time that I'd been fielding questions about whether I was afraid to be a woman alone, the assumption that a woman alone would be preyed upon, I'd been the recipient of one kindness after another. Aside from the creepy experience with the sandy-haired guy who jammed my water purifier and the couple who'd booted me from the campground in California, I had nothing but generosity to report. The world and its people had opened their arms to me at every turn. As if on cue, the old man leaned over the cash register.
Young lady, I wanted to tell you that if you want to stay another night and dry out, we'd let you have one of these cabins for next to nothing.
I turned to the three young bucks with a question in my eyes. Within 15 minutes, we'd moved into our cabin, hanging our soft sleeping bags over the dusty rafters. The cabin was one wood-paneled room, taken up almost entirely by two double beds that sat on antediluvian metal frames that squeaked if he so much as leaned on the bed. Once we settled in, I walked back to the store in the rain to buy snacks. When I stepped inside, Lisa was standing there by the wood stove. Lisa, who lived in Portland. Lisa, who'd been mailing my boxes all summer long. Lisa, whom I'd be moving in with in a week. "Hello," she half-screamed while we grabbed each other. "I knew you'd be here right about now," she said, once we'd recovered from the shock. "We decided to drive up and see." She turned to her boyfriend, Jason, and I shook his hand. I'd met him briefly in the days before I'd left Portland for the PCT, when they'd first begun dating. It felt surreal to see people I knew from my old familiar world, and a bit sad, too. I was both happy and disappointed to see them. Their presence seemed to hasten the end of my trip, underlining the fact that though it would take me a week to get there, Portland was only 90 miles away by car. By evening, we all piled into Jason's pickup truck and drove along the winding forest roads to Bagby Hot Springs. Bagby is a version of Paradise in the Woods, a tri-level series of wooden decks that hold tubs of various configurations on a steaming hot creek a mile and a half walk back from a roadside parking area in the Mount Hood National Forest. It's not a business or a resort or a retreat center. It's just a place anyone can go for no charge at any hour of the day or night to soak in the natural waters beneath an ancient canopy of Douglas firs, hemlocks, and cedars. Its existence seemed more surreal to me than Lisa standing in the Olali Lake store. We practically had the place to ourselves. The three young bucks and I walked to the lower deck, where there were long, hand-hewn tubs as big as canoes made from hollowed-out cedars beneath a high, airy wooden ceiling. We undressed as the rain fell gently down on the lush branches of the big trees that surrounded us, my eyes skating over their naked bodies in the half-light. Rick and I got into neighboring tubs and turned on the spigots, moaning as the hot, mineral-rich water rose around us. I remembered my bath in that hotel in Sierra City before I hiked up into the snow. It seemed fitting that I was here now, with only a week left to go, like I'd survived a hard and beautiful dream. I'd ridden up front with Lisa and Jason on the drive to Bagby, but on the return trip to Olali Lake, I climbed in back with the three young bucks, feeling clean and warm and blissed out as I clambered onto the futon that covered the truck's bed. "That futon is yours, by the way," said Lisa, before she closed the camper hatch behind us. "I took it out of your truck and put it in here in case we decided to spend the night." "Welcome to my bed, boys," I said in a mockingly lascivious tone, to cover for the dislocation I felt at the prospect that this really was my bed, the futon I'd shared with Paul for years. The thought of him dimmed my ecstatic mood. I hadn't yet opened the letter he'd sent me. In contrast to the customary envelope-ripping glee with which I usually greeted mail, the sight of his familiar handwriting had given me pause this time. I'd decided to read it once I was back on the trail, perhaps because I knew that this would prevent me from mailing off an immediate reply, from saying rash and passionate things that weren't true any longer. "I'll always be married to you in my heart," I'd told him on the day we'd filed for divorce. It had been only 5 months ago, but already I doubted what I'd said. My love for him was indisputable. My allegiance to him wasn't. We were no longer married. And as I settled alongside the three young bucks into the bed I used to share with Paul, I felt a kind of acceptance of that, a kind of clarity where there'd been so much uncertainty. The four of us lay wedged in across the futon's expanse as the truck bumped over the dark roads, me, Rick, Josh, and Richie, in that order, across the truck's bed. There wasn't an inch to spare, just as it had been on the deranged ranger's couch the night before. The side of Rick's body was pressed against mine, ever so slightly tilted in my direction and away from Josh. The sky had finally cleared, and I could see the almost full moon. "Look," I said just to Rick, gesturing toward the window of the camper at the sky. We spoke quietly of the moons we'd seen on the trail, and where we'd been when we'd seen them, and of the trail ahead. "You'll have to give me Lisa's number so we can hang out in Portland," he said. "I'll be living there too after I finish the trail."
"Absolutely, we'll hang out," I said.
"For sure," he said, and looked at me in this delicate way that made me swoon. Though I realized that, in spite of the fact that I liked him perhaps 1,000 times more than a good number of the people I'd slept with, I wasn't going to lay a hand on him, no matter how deeply I longed to. Laying a hand on him was as far away as the moon. And it wasn't just because he was younger than me, or because two of his friends were in bed with us, pressed up against his very back. It was because, for once, it was finally enough for me to simply lie there in a restrained and chaste rapture beside a sweet, strong, sexy, smart, good man who was probably never meant to be anything but my friend. For once, I didn't ache for a companion. For once, the phrase, "a woman with a hole in her heart," didn't thunder into my head. That phrase, it didn't even live for me anymore.
"I'm really glad I met you," I said.
"Me too," said Rick. "Who wouldn't be glad to meet the queen of the PCT? I smiled at him and turned to gaze out the little window at the moon again, intensely aware of the side of his body so warm against mine as we lay together in an exquisitely conscious silence.
"Very nice," said Rick after a while. "Very nice," he repeated, with more emphasis the second time.
"What is?" I asked, turning to him, though I knew.
"Everything," he said.
And it was true.
Chapter 19. The Dream of a Common Language. The next morning, the sky was clear blue, the sun shimmering on Olali Lake, views of Mount Jefferson framed perfectly to the south, and Olali Butte to the north. I sat on one of the picnic tables near the ranger station, packing Monster for the final stretch of my hike. The three young bucks had left at dawn, in a hurry to reach Canada before the high Cascades of Washington were snowed in, but I wasn't going that far. I could take my time. Guy appeared with a box in his hands, sober now, breaking me out of my contemplative trance.
"I'm glad I caught you before you left. This just came," he said.
I took the box from him and glanced at the return address. It was from my friend Gretchen.
"Thanks for everything," I said to Guy as he walked away, "for the drinks the other night and the hospitality."
"Stay safe out there," he said,
and disappeared around the corner of the building. I ripped open the box and gasped when I saw what was inside, 12 fancy chocolates in shiny twisted wrappers and a bottle of red wine. I ate some chocolate immediately while pondering the wine. Much as I wanted to open it that night on the trail, I wasn't willing to lug the empty bottle all the way to Timberline Lodge. I packed up the last of my things, strapped on Monster, picked up the wine and the empty box, and began to walk to the ranger station.
"Cheryl," a voice boomed, and I turned.
"There you are, there you are. I caught you,
shouted a man as he came at me. I was so startled, I dropped the box on the grass as the man shook his fists in the air and let out a joyous hoot that I recognized but couldn't place. He was young and bearded and golden, different and yet the same as the last time I'd seen him.
"Cheryl," he yelled again, as he practically tackled me into an embrace. It was as if time moved in slow motion, from the moment that I didn't know who he was to the moment that I did know, but I couldn't take it into my consciousness until he had me all the way in his arms and I yelled,
"Doug! Doug, Doug, Doug," I kept saying. "Cheryl, Cheryl, Cheryl," he said to me.
Then we went silent and stepped back and looked at each other.
"You've lost weight," he said.
"So have you," I said.
"You're all broken in now," he said.
"I know, so are you."
"I have a beard," he said, tugging on it. "I have so much to tell you."
"Me too. Where's Tom?"
"He's a few miles back. He'll catch up later."
"Did you make it through the snow?" I asked.
"We did some, but it got to be too intense, and we came down and ended up bypassing."
I shook my head, still shocked he was standing there.
I told him about Greg getting off the trail and asked him about Albert and Matt. I haven't heard anything about them since we saw them last.
He looked at me and smiled, his eyes sparkling to life. We read your notes in the register all summer long. They motivated us to crank. We wanted to catch up to you.
I was just leaving now, I said.
I bent to retrieve the empty box I'd dropped in the excitement. Another minute and I'd have been gone, and who knows if you'd have caught me.
I'd have caught you, he said, and laughed in that golden boy way that I remembered so vividly, though it was altered now, too. He was grittier than he'd been before, slightly more shaken, as if he'd aged a few years in the past months.
You want to hang out while I organize my things and we can leave together?
Sure, I said without hesitation. I've got to hike those last days before I get into Cascade Locks alone, you know, just to finish like I started. But let's hike together to Timberline Lodge.
Holy shit, Cheryl.
He pulled me in for another hug.
I can't believe we're here together.
Hey, you still have that black feather I gave you. He reached to touch its ragged edge. It was my good luck charm, I said.
What's with the wine? He asked, pointing to the bottle in my hand.
I'm going to give it to the ranger, I replied, lifting it high. I don't want to carry it all the way to Timberline.
Are you insane? Doug asked.
Give me that bottle. We opened it that night at our camp near the Warm Springs River with the corkscrew on my Swiss Army knife. The day had warmed into the low 70s, but the evening was cool, the crisp edge of summer turning to autumn everywhere around us. The leaves on the trees had thinned almost undetectably. The tall stalks of wildflowers bent down onto themselves, plumped with rot. Doug and I built a fire as our dinners cooked, and then sat eating from our pots and passing the wine back and forth, drinking straight from the bottle since neither of us had a cup. The wine and the fire, and being in Doug's company again after all this time, felt like a rite of passage, like a ceremonial marking of the end of my journey. After a while, we each turned abruptly toward the darkness, hearing the yip of coyotes more near than far.
That sound always makes my hair stand on end, Doug said.
He took a sip from the bottle and handed it to me.
This wine's really good.
It is, I agreed and took a swig. I heard coyotes a lot this summer, I said.
And you weren't afraid, right? Isn't that what you told yourself?
It is what I told myself, I said. Except every once in a while, I added, when I was.
Me too.
He reached over and rested his hand on my shoulder, and I put my hand on his and squeezed it. He felt like a brother of mine, but not at all like my actual brother. He seemed like someone I'd always know, even if I never saw him again. When we were done with the wine, I went to Monster and pulled out the Ziploc bag that held my books. You need something to read? I asked Doug, holding the 10,000 things up to him, but he shook his head. I'd finished it a few days before, though I hadn't been able to burn it because of the rain. Unlike most of the other books I'd read on my hike, I'd already read the 10,000 things when I'd packed it into my resupply box months before. A densely lyrical novel set in the Moluccan Islands in Indonesia, it had been written in Dutch and published to critical acclaim in 1955, but mostly forgotten now. I'd never met anyone who'd read the book, aside from the college writing professor who'd assigned it to me in the fiction workshop I was enrolled in when my mother got sick. The title hadn't been lost on me as I'd sat dutifully reading it in my mother's hospital room, attempting to shut out my fear and sorrow by forcing my mind to focus on passages I hoped to refer to in the following week's class discussion. But it was useless. I couldn't think of anything but my mom. Besides, I already knew about the 10,000 things. They were all the named and unnamed things in the world, and together they added up to less than how much my mother loved me, and me her. So when I was packing for the PCT, I decided to give the book another chance. I hadn't had any trouble focusing this time. From the very first page, I understood. Each of Dermot's sentences came at me like a soft, knowing dagger, depicting a far-off land that felt to me like the blood of all the places I used to love. I think I'm going to turn in, said Doug, holding the empty bottle of wine. Tom will probably catch up to us tomorrow.
I'll put the fire out, I said.
When he was gone, I ripped the pages of the 10,000 Things from their gummy paperback binding and set them into the fire in thin clumps, prodding them with a stick until they burned. As I stared at the flames, I thought about Eddie, the same as I did just about every time I sat by a fire. It had been he who taught me how to build one. Eddie was the one who'd taken me camping the first time. He'd shown me how to pitch a tent and tie a knot in a rope. From him, I'd learned how to open a can with a jackknife and paddle a canoe and skip a rock on the surface of a lake. In the 3 years after he fell in love with my mother, he'd taken us camping and canoeing along the Minnesota and St. Croix and Namekagon rivers practically every weekend from June to September, and after we'd moved north, onto the land my family had bought with the proceeds from his broken back, he taught me even more about the woods. There's no way to know what makes one thing happen and not another, what leads to what destroys what causes what to flourish or die or take another course. But I was pretty certain as I sat there that night that if it hadn't been for Eddie, I wouldn't have found myself on the PCT. And though it was true that everything I felt for him sat like a boulder in my throat, this realization made the boulder sit ever so much lighter. He hadn't loved me well in the end, but he'd loved me well when it mattered. When the 10,000 Things had turned to ash, I pulled out the other book in my Ziploc bag. It was The Dream of a Common Language. I'd carried it all this way, though I hadn't opened it since that first night on the trail. I hadn't needed to. I knew what it said. Its lines had run all summer through the mixtape radio station in my head, fragments from various poems, or sometimes the title of the book itself, which was also a line from a poem, The Dream of a Common Language. I opened the book and paged through it, leaning forward so I could see the words by the firelight. I read a line or two from a dozen or so of the poems, each of them so familiar they gave me a strange sort of comfort. I chanted those lines silently through the days while I hiked. Often, I didn't know exactly what they meant. Yet there was another way in which I knew their meaning entirely, as if it were all before me and yet out of my grasp, their meaning like a fish just beneath the surface of the water that I tried to catch with my bare hands, so close and present and belonging to me, until I reached for it and it flashed away. I closed the book and looked at its beige cover. There was no reason not to burn this book, too. Instead, I only hugged it to my chest. We reached Timberline Lodge a couple of days later. By then, it wasn't just Doug and me. Tom had caught up to us, and we'd also been joined by two women, a 20-something ex-couple who were hiking Oregon and a small section of Washington. The five of us hiked together in duos and trios of various formations, or sometimes all of us in a row, making a leisurely party of it, the vibe festive because of our numbers, and the cool, sunny days. On our long breaks, we played hacky sack and skinny dipped in an icy cold lake, incited the wrath of a handful of hornets, and then ran from them while we laughed and screamed. By the time we reached Timberline Lodge, 6,000 feet up on the south flank of Mount Hood, we were like a tribe, bonded in that way I imagined kids felt when they spent a week together at summer camp. It was mid-afternoon when we arrived. In the lounge, the five of us took over a pair of couches that faced each other across a low wooden table and ordered terribly expensive sandwiches. Then afterwards, sipped coffee spiked with Bailey's while we played poker and Rummy 500 with a deck of cards we borrowed from the bartender. The slope of Mount Hood rose above us just outside the lodge's windows. At 11,240 feet, it's Oregon's highest mountain, a volcano like all the others I'd passed since I entered the Cascade Range south of Lassen Peak way back in July. But this, the last of the major mountains I'd traverse on my hike, felt like the most important, and not only because I was sitting on its very haunches. The sight of it had become familiar to me, its imposing grandeur visible from Portland on clear days. Once I reached Mount Hood, I realized
I felt ever so slightly like I was home. Portland, where I'd never technically lived, in spite of all that had happened in the 8 or 9 months I'd spent there over the past 2 years, was only 60 miles away. From afar, the sight of Mount Hood had never failed to take my breath away, but up close, it was different. The way everything is, it was less coolly majestic, at once more ordinary and more immeasurable in its gritty authority. The landscape outside the north windows of the lodge was not the glistening white peak one sees from miles away, but a grayish and slightly barren slope dotted with a few scraggly strands of pines and a smattering of lupin and asters that grew among the rocks. The natural landscape was punctuated by a ski lift that led to the crusty swath of snow farther up. I was happy to be protected from the mountain for a time, ensconced inside the glorious lodge, a wonderland in the rough. It's a grand stone and wood structure that was hand-hewn by Works Progress Administration workers in the mid-1930s. Everything about the place has a story. The art on the walls, the architecture of the building, the hand-woven fabrics that cover the furniture, each piece carefully crafted to reflect the history, culture, and natural resources of the Pacific Northwest. I excused myself from the others and walked slowly through the lodge, then stepped out onto a wide, south-facing patio. It was a clear, sunny day, and I could see for more than 100 miles. The view included so many of the mountains I'd hiked past, two of the Three Sisters and Mount Jefferson and Broken Finger. Hop, skip, spin, done, I thought. I was here. I was almost there, but I wasn't done. I still had 50 miles to walk before I reached the Bridge of the Gods. The next morning, I said goodbye to Doug and Tom and the two women, and I hiked away alone, climbing up the short, steep path that went from the lodge to the PCT. I passed under the ski lift and edged my way north and west around the shoulder of Mount Hood on a trail of what seemed to be demolished rock, worn down by the harsh winters into a pebbly sand. By the time I crossed into the Mount Hood wilderness 20 minutes later, I had entered the forest again, and I felt the silence descend on me. It felt good to be alone. It felt spectacular. It was the middle of September, but the sun was warm and bright, the sky bluer than ever. The trail opened up into miles-wide views and then closed around me into dense woods before opening back up again. I walked for 10 miles without pause, crossed the sandy river, and stopped to sit on a small flat shelf, looking over it from the other side. Nearly all the pages of the Pacific Crest Trail Volume 2, Oregon and Washington, were gone by now. What was left of my guidebook was folded into the pocket of my shorts. I took out the pages and read them again, letting myself go all the way to the end. I was thrilled by the prospect of reaching Cascade Locks, and also saddened by it. I didn't know how living outdoors and sleeping on the ground in a tent each night and walking alone through the wilderness all day, almost every day, had come to feel like my normal life, but it had. It was the idea of not doing it that scared me. I went to the river and squatted down and splashed my face. It was narrow and shallow here, so late in the summer and so high up, barely bigger than a stream. Where was my mother? I wondered. I'd carried her so long, staggering beneath her weight. On the other side of the river, I let myself think. And something inside of me released. In the days that followed, I passed Ramona Falls and skirted in and out of the Columbia Wilderness. I caught views of Mount St. Helens and Rainier and Adams far to the north. I reached Wadham Lake and turned off the PCT and onto the alternate route the authors of my guidebook recommended, which would lead me down to Eagle Creek and into the Columbia River Gorge and eventually to the river itself that ran alongside the town of Cascade Locks. Down, down, down I went on that last full day of hiking, descending 4,000 feet in just over 16 miles. The creeks and streams and trailside seeps I crossed and paralleled, going down and down too. I could feel the river pulling me like a great magnet below and to the north. I could feel myself coming to the end of things. I stopped to spend the night on the banks of Eagle Creek. It was 5 o'clock, and I was only 6 miles away from Cascade Locks. I could have been in town by dark, but I didn't want to finish my trip that way. I wanted to take my time, to see the river and the Bridge of the Gods in the bright light of day. That evening, I sat next to Eagle Creek watching the water rush over the rocks. My feet were killing me from the long descent. Even after all this way, with my body now stronger than it had ever been and would likely ever be, hiking on the PCT still hurt. New blisters had formed on my toes in places that had gone soft from the relatively few extreme descents throughout Oregon. I put my fingers delicately to them, soothing them with my touch. Another toenail looked like it was finally going to come off. I gave it a gentle tug, and it was in my hand, my sixth. I had only 4 intact toenails left. The PCT and I weren't tied anymore. The score was 4-6, advantage trail. I slept on my tarp, not wanting to shelter myself on that last night, and woke before dawn to watch the sunrise over Mount Hood. It was really over, I thought. There was no way to go back to make it stay. There was never that. I sat for a long while, letting the light fill the sky, letting it expand and reach down into the trees. I closed my eyes and listened hard to Eagle Creek. It was running to the Columbia River, like me. I seemed to float the 4 miles to the little parking area near the head of the Eagle Creek Trail, buoyed by a pure, unadulterated emotion that can only be described as joy. I strolled through the mostly empty parking lot and past the restrooms, then followed another trail that would take me the 2 miles into Cascade Locks. The trail turned sharply to the right, and before me was the Columbia River, visible through the chain-link fence that bordered the trail to set it off from Interstate 84 just below. I stopped and grasped the fence and stared. It seemed like a miracle that I finally had the river in my sights, as if a newborn baby had just slipped finally into my palms after a long labor. That glimmering dark water was more beautiful than anything I'd imagined during all those miles I'd hiked to reach it. I walked east along a lush green corridor, the roadbed of the long-abandoned Columbia River Highway, which had been made into a trail. I could see patches of concrete in places, but the road had mostly been reclaimed by the moss that grew along the rocks at the road's edge, the trees that hung heavy and low over it, the spiders who'd spun webs that crossed its expanse. I walked through the spider webs, feeling them like magic on my face, pulling them out of my hair. I could hear but not see the rush of automobiles on the interstate to my left, which ran between the river and me, the ordinary sound of them, a great whooshing whine and hum. When I emerged from the forest, I was in Cascade Locks, which, unlike so many towns on the trail, was an actual town, with a population of a little more than 1,000. It was Friday morning, and I could feel the Friday morningness emanating from the houses I passed. I walked beneath the freeway and wended my way along the streets with my ski pole clicking against the pavement, my heart racing when the bridge came into view. It's an elegant steel truss cantilever named for a natural bridge that was formed by a major landslide approximately 300 years ago that had temporarily dammed the Columbia River. The local Native Americans had called it the Bridge of the Gods. The human-made structure that took its name spans the Columbia for a little more than 1/3 of a mile, connecting Oregon to Washington, the town of Cascade Locks, and Stevenson on either side. There's a toll booth on the Oregon side, and when I reached it, the woman who worked inside told me I could cross the bridge no charge. "I'm not crossing," I said. "I only want to touch it." I walked along the shoulder of the road, until I reached the concrete stanchion of the bridge, put my hand on it, and looked down at the Columbia River flowing beneath me. It's the largest river in the Pacific Northwest and the 4th largest in the nation. Native Americans have lived on the river for thousands of years, sustained by its once bountiful salmon for most of them. Meriwether Lewis and William Clark had paddled down the Columbia in dugout canoes on their famous expedition in 1805. 190 years later, 2 days before my 27th birthday, here I was. I had arrived. I'd done it. It seemed like such a small thing and such a tremendous thing at once, like a secret I'd always tell myself, though I didn't know the meaning of it just yet. I stood there for several minutes, cars and trucks going past me, feeling like I'd cry, though I didn't. Weeks before, I'd heard on the trail grapevine that once I reached Cascade Locks, I had to go to the East Wind Drive-In for one of their famously large ice cream cones. For that reason, I'd saved a couple of dollars when I was at Timberline Lodge. I left the bridge and made my way along a busy street that ran parallel to the river and the interstate. The road and much of the town were sandwiched between the two. It was still morning and the drive-in wasn't open yet, so I sat on the little white wooden bench in front with Monster by my side. I would be in Portland later that day. It was only 45 miles away to the west. I'd sleep on my old futon beneath a roof. I'd unpack my CDs and stereo and listen to any song I liked. I'd wear my black lace bra and underwear and blue jeans. I'd consume all the amazing foods and drinks that could be had. I'd drive my truck anywhere I wanted to go. I'd set up my computer and write my novel. I'd take the boxes of books I'd brought with me from Minnesota and sell them the next day at Powell's, so I'd have some cash. I'd have a yard sale to see me through until I got a job. I'd set out my thrift store dresses and miniature binoculars and foldable saw on the grass and get for them anything I could. The thought of it all astounded me. "We're ready for you," a woman called, poking her head out of the sliding window that fronted the drive-in. I ordered a chocolate vanilla twist cone. A few moments later, she handed it to me and took my $2 and gave me 2 dimes in change. It was the last money I had in the world. 20 cents. I sat on the white bench and ate every bit of my cone, and then watched the cars again. I was the only customer at the drive-in until a BMW pulled up and a young man in a business suit got out. "Hi," he said to me as he passed. He was about my age, his hair gelled back, his shoes impeccable. Once he had his cone, he returned to stand near me. "Looks like you've been backpacking."
"Yes, on the Pacific Crest Trail. I walked over 1,100 miles," I said, too excited to contain myself. "I just finished my trip this morning."
"Really?" I nodded and laughed. "That's incredible. I've always wanted to do something like that. A big journey."
"You could. You should. Believe me, if I can do this, anyone can."
"I can't get the time off of work." "I'm an attorney," he said. He tossed the uneaten half of his cone into the garbage can and wiped his hands on a napkin. "What are you gonna do now?"
"Go to Portland. I'm gonna live there a while."
"I live there, too. I'm on my way there now. If you want a ride, I'd be happy to drop you off wherever you'd like."
"Thanks," I said, "but I want to stay here for a while. Just to take it all in."
He pulled a business card from his wallet and handed it to me. "Give me a call once you settle in. I'd love to take you out to lunch and hear more about your trip."
"Okay," I said, looking at the card. It was white with blue embossed letters, a relic from another world.
"It was an honor to meet you at this momentous juncture," he said.
"Nice to meet you too," I said, shaking his hand.
After he drove away, I leaned my head back and closed my eyes against the sun as the tears I'd expected earlier at the bridge began to seep from my eyes.
"Thank you," I thought over and over again. "Thank you. Not just for the long walk, but for everything I could feel finally gathered up inside of me. For everything the trail had taught me and everything I couldn't yet know. Though I felt it somehow already contained within me. How I'd never see the man in the BMW again, but how in 4 years I'd cross the Bridge of the Gods with another man and marry him in a spot almost visible from where I now sat. How in 9 years that man and I would have a son named Carver,
And a year and a half after that, a daughter named Bobby. How in 15 years I'd bring my family to this same white bench and the four of us would eat ice cream cones while I told them the story of the time I'd been here once before when I'd